especially for the neophyte devotee. We should be very careful to avoid these 10 offenses so that we can quickly rise to the platform of Namavas. So he says to speak ill of sadhus or to calumniate them or to offend them. And he gives a note here, this is the first offense to the holy name. One should differentiate between a genuine sadhu and a pseudo-sadhu. To show respect to a false person in the garb of a sadhu as equal to a genuine sadhu or saint, and to disrespect a genuine saint, mistaking him to be a sham, one will be equally an offense to the name of the Supreme Lord. Because a sadhu or devotee is dear to the Lord, and the Lord is displeased with one who offends his true devotee, while honoring one who brings disgrace to himself and the Lord by pretending to be a sadhu. 2. To meditate in the presence of the Supreme Lord Vishnu on the name, form, qualities of Lord Shiva as an independent Lord is an offense to the name of Lord Hari. But then he goes on to explain in his note about citing Brahma Samhita, where Lord Brahma explains that as milk is transformed by acid to become yogurt, so Vishnu, when he transforms by the acidic contact with the material world, then that form that contacts the material world is Shiva. So in the he says, as milk is turned into yogurt, when it contacts sour, Vishnu becomes Rudra when he contacts his own external potency, Mahamaya, Bahiranga Shakti. So Shiva, Rudra, is the changed aspect of Lord Vishnu. Hence, to meditate on Shiva as the independent Lord in the presence of Vishnu is an offense to the name of the Lord. 3. To disregard the spiritual preceptor is an offense to the name of Godhead. One can receive the transcendental name of the Lord as distinct from a mundane word only from the spiritual master. Hence, to disrespect the Guru is naturally an offense to the name of the Lord. One must be very cautious, again, about who is a genuine and qualified guru in one's spiritual life and who is not. In 7th Canto of Bhagavatam, Prahlad Maharaj has differentiated between a preceptor of mundane values of life and a spiritual preceptor, guru, who helps one out of the dirt and filth of this phenomenal world and its blandishments and raises the disciple to a higher level of spiritual awakening for the attainment of the absolute value of human birth and self-realization and God-realization. Quite a long sentence. Because, as you know, Prahlad Maharaj was a 5-year-old boy attending the so-called Gurukul of his father. It was not actually Gurukul, it was Asurakul. And the teachers were not gurus, they were asuras. And their names were Shandanamarka. Why were they considered to be asuras, not gurus? Because they're not heavily laden with transcendental knowledge. Guru is laden, he's heavy, with spiritual knowledge by which one realizes God, by which one links with God, or understands God. But Shandanamarka were heavenly laden with mundane knowledge, politics, diplomacy, ballistics, and other mundane subjects, economics, poli-sci, computer sci, computer science, biology, philosophy, psychology, all the so-called modern sciences. So, ordinarily, all the boys in school were respecting Shandanamarka. Oh, these are our gurus, these are our teachers. But to disrespect such a spiritual preceptor is not an offense to the holy name. But the actual guru, just like in India, they have Kula Guru. They have family gurus that perform various rituals on behalf of the family. Dasavita samskaras, the namkarana, namkarana and chudakarana, and the vidyakarana, and the garbha samskara. All these different samskaras, birth, conception samskara, the name, giving of name, and the cutting of the sika, hair cutting, first hair cutting, leaving a sika, shika, and the giving of chalk, beginning of education, Vidya Samskara. So these gurus, they perform homa, yajna, and give some benedictions and blessings, and guidance, and maybe cast a astrology chart for the child. They're called Kula Guru. Kula means family. Family Guru. And one can show some regard and respect. We respect even an aunt. But these aren't really spiritual preceptors. So it's to disregard the spiritual preceptor is an offense to the name of Godhead. For example, Chandana Marka were disrespected by Prahlad. Prahlad wasn't so keen on following their mundane teachings. But their guru, they were the gurus of the Asura Kul. They were the teachers. Their teacher, guru means teacher. So they were supposed to be respected, but Prahlad wasn't very particularly respectful of them. Because at every opportune moment, or at every opportunity, Prahlad Maharaj was teaching about Vishnu, Vishnu Bhakti, and Vishnu Tattva, and engaging his friends in Nam Sankirtan, chanting and dancing. You see in the plays, sometimes they have plays in the ISKCON. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. This is the melody that they were singing back in the 70s for this Prahlad plays. Prahlad would come out with his school friends. Komarat Acharet Pragyo Dharman Bhagavatamiha. That Komarat, from the age of 1 to birth to 5 years old, Kumar, Krishna Kumar. Komarat Acharet Pragyo Dharman Bhagavatamiha. That one should begin, behave properly, and engage in Bhagavad Dharma, hearing and chanting by Krishna. So Prahlad gathered all his 5-year-old friends during the tiffin hour, as Prabhupada says. Tiffin hour means lunchbox time. Well, we have our lunchboxes in school, but they have their tiffins. So during tiffin hour means lunchtime, school break. Prahlad would get all his friends in the courtyard and hold hands with them and clap hands and say, okay, boys, let's get down. Let's get down and have a kirtan. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And it goes on like this. Prahlad's melody, Prahlad's raga. So, very joyful raga, morning raga. So he didn't listen to his schoolmasters. He disrespected them. So is that an offense to the holy name? It says it's third offense, disregard the spiritual preceptor. And that's why he's telling you must differentiate between a genuine a preceptor of mundane values and a spiritual preceptor, guru. So there's a Kula Guru and a Sadguru. A Sadguru is a guru that links you with eternity and eternally guides you to the lotus feet of Krishna. 4, to condemn the scriptures is an offense to the holy name of the Lord, because the scriptures establish that the name of the Lord and the Lord himself are one and identical. Hence, to disbelieve the scriptures is to disbelieve the Lord himself. 5, to take the glories of the name of God that have been mentioned in scriptures as exaggerated eulogies is an offense, because actually no praise is sufficient enough to glorify the unlimited efficacy of the name of God. And no praise can be sufficient enough to express the glories of the Godhead. 6, to give an indirect and forced meaning to the name of the Lord is an offense. For an example, when the scriptures use the Lord's name as Hari to explain it away in that context, that the word Hari means lion or lotus is an offense. Sorry. Hari can't mean that in Sanskrit. Actually, it's the Lord's name. 7, to commit sins on the strength of the holy name. And then 8, consider the chanting of the Lord's name as an equivalent or alternative to so many other kinds of good deeds is an offense. 9, to advise a disbeliever on the name of the Lord or to initiate a disbeliever in the name of the Lord is an offense. That's interesting. 10, to have no taste for the chanting of the name of the Lord, even after listening to all the super excellences of the name, is an offense. We usually say to not have faith, isn't it? We say the 10th offense is not have faith in chanting, even after hearing so many instructions of the matter. Well, here it talks about ruchi, to not have taste. after listening to all the wonderful qualities of the holy name. So taste comes by repeated practice. So this brings us to chapter 9, Nectar Devotion. New chapter. Further consideration of devotional principles. Then in this chapter, we'll discuss now positive principles. Now we're back to the positive things. Dancing before the deity, bowing down before the deity, Tulsi Bees, Tilak, Archan, rendering service to the Lord, singing Sankirtan, Japa, submission, reciting notable prayers, touching the deity, drinking Charanamrita, partaking prasad, seeing a deity and observing arati. These are all good things, devotional practices. First one, of course, is a continuation from the last chapter, blasphemy. One should not tolerate blasphemy of the Lord or his devotees. In this connection, 10th canto, Shukadeva tells Pariksit, "My dear king, if a person after hearing blasphemous propaganda against the Lord and his devotees does not go away from that place, he becomes bereft of the effect of all his pious activities." So there are three ways of dealing with such insults. One, if you hear blasphemy, you should be so expert you can defeat the opposing you can offer arguments. Second, if you can't defeat the opposition, you should give up your life. The third, if you can't do any of the above two, then you must get the hell out of there. You must leave the place as fast as possible. If you can't defeat the opposition and are not prepared to sacrifice your body, then you better put your tail between your legs and hightail it out of there to leave that place. This is actually in a list of the 64 items of devotional service. This is number 20. And this whole previous chapter, number 8, with all these different offenses to avoid, that was all coming under the 19th principle. Vishwanath also comments on this. Because the 19th principle, which we've been discussing all by these aparads, is called Seva Aparad Nam Aparad Tyag. To give up all offenses in regard to Seva and Nam. So we discussed so many Seva aparads. Touching a deity in a dark room, stepping over the deity's flowers, breaking silence by worshipping, passing air before the deity, getting up to pass water in the middle of puja. These are all Seva aparads in Archan. Then we heard about the 10 aparads in the holy name. So that was all principle 19 out of the 64 limbs of devotion. This is principle 20.
Guru Krishna Bhakta Ninda Sahana Tyag. One should not tolerate blasphemy of Sri Guru, Sri Krishna, or the devotees. If one is unable to give suitable punishment to such an offender, he should cover his ears, leave that place, and take a bath with his clothes on.
We hear from Chaitanya Bhagavat that Lord Chaitanya, when he was living in Mayapur, whenever he saw the face of a materialistic person, whenever he saw the face of, what to speak of hearing blasphemy with the Lord, whenever he saw the face of a materialistic person, a Vishayi Jana, a man absorbed in sense gratification, a lusty man, a greedy man, an envious man, any materialistic man, as soon as he saw his face, Lord Chaitanya would jump in the Ganges with his dhoti and chatter and his school books or whatever. I don't know about his books, but he would jump in with all his clothes on. It's described there. So apparently, 500 years ago, although we hear that the condition of Navadvip was quite degraded, quite deplorable, people were very much materialistic, spending lavishly for the worship of Chandi and Devi, and ridiculously spending on marriages, and worshipping of useless deities and demigoddesses that were just contrived or made up, half of them, for mundane materialistic purposes. So they were mad after all these foolish activities, even 500 years ago, which indicates that people were extremely materialistic. somehow or other, it differentiates that Mahaprabhu one day saw some extremely, extremely materialistic man, and he jumped in the Ganges to purify himself of the contamination of seeing that man's face. So by that standard of behavior, today all of us should just fly to Mayapur and submerge ourselves in the Ganges and not come up, and not come out, because we're surrounded by so many extremely lusty people and greedy people in the newspapers and on television, and what to speak of on the sidewalks and planes and public places we frequent. They're completely infested with the most abominable and wretched type of materialistic sense enjoyers. So we should, when we meet a blasphemer, we should jump in the Rhine River or the Thames or wherever river you happen to be in. Of course, by jumping in that river, you may die of some kind of acid poisoning or whatever. So it may be better to die in at the hands of the blasphemer. You jump in the river, counteract the contamination of seeing a materialistic person. When you contact the river water, you might die of acid, burn your skin and the acid in the water. There was once back in the 70s, one river, Cayon River in Chicago, it caught on fire. The most bizarre act. It took a couple of weeks to put out the fire. The river was on fire. The whole port was closed. It was a port off of the Great Lakes from Canada coming into Chicago or something. The Cayon River. And the whole river was on fire for several weeks. So someone will say, oh, how is the river on fire? And there's no way they could put it out. So the water itself was on fire because some oil tanker had cracked open and split open or whatever. And all the oil and gas was poured out of the thing all over the river, the tanker. And oil is lighter than water, so it just floated on the water. And it caught on fire. So the water was burning for 3 weeks continuously, and they couldn't do anything to put it out. Finally, all the oil burned up. There's funny thing to see in the television, showing you pictures of a river on fire. At any rate, this is a Vishnu is telling it that like that. By hearing blasphemy, bhakti vritti, these are the thought ways of devotion, or the active principle of bhakti becomes withered. Those who blaspheme Krishna and the Vaishnavas are offenders who are averse to Krishna. It says in the Bhagavatam 10:74-40, Nindam Bhagavata Shranvams Tatparasya Janasyava Tato Nai Paiti Yaso Pi Yat Yadha Sukrita Yudha. Those who hear blasphemy of Bhagavan are as devotees and do not leave that place are deprived of their auspicious activities and fall down to a great degraded position. The 44 angas of bhakti which follow after this one are included in the 20 angas already mentioned. They have been described as separate angas in order to understand the subject matter elaborately. So we've already discussed 20 angas of bhakti. Now we're again going with 44 more, which makes 64. They're actually already included in the first 20. So this next one, which is 21, it's called Tilak and Tulsi Beads. In Sanskrit, it's Vaishnav Chinna. Chinna means the marks. The adopting of the outward signs of Vaishnava. So, this is Padmapuran. Person wears Tulsi Beads on his neck and marks his body in 12 places as a Vishnu temple. He's understood to be a devotee of Vishnu in this world. Jiva Goswami says you can also wear, aside from marking your body, you can wear a garland of lotus seeds around the neck. Some devotees wear lotus seeds. Rupa Goswami used to wear a datri fruit seed mala. Always. Datri. One commentary. Then it talks about stamping the body with the letters of the holy name of the Lord, like Sri Radhe or or Hare Krishna. Sometimes they sell these wooden stamps. Put on your forehead or put on your chest. Stamp your body. A person whose body is decorated with sandalwood, where he's painting the holy names of the Lord, is delivered from all sinful reactions. And after his death, he goes directly to Krishna Loka to live in the association with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's very nice. Take some chandan and mark your forehead with the name Sri Krishna. Certainly you get a good benediction there. Hari Bhakti Vilas says that without wearing a tulsi mala, all the auspicious religious performances, such as Bhagavad Archan and Bhagavad Upasana, are fruitless. So this, in other words, all the worship of the deity and the different angas of bhakti, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, because Bhagavad Archan means Archan, worship of the Lord, and Upasana means the various forms of Upasana, or worship, which includes Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. Upasana, the word upasana literally means upa-asan, asana, to sit near by means of the heart. So we say Vishnu upasanam or bhakti upasana means upasana, to sit near the heart and offer the Lord devotion or worship the Lord with devotion, bhakti upasana. To sit near by means of the heart. Thus Bhagavad upasana refers to all those activities by which one approaches the Lord through the heart in order to offer worship. So one should always wear a tulsi necklace when he's at all times. Then you can also wear auspicious necklaces made of lotus seeds, rudraksha beads, amalaki, tulsi, and so on. Vaishnavas primarily wear tulsi, because tulsi is supremely pure and very dear to Bhagavan. By wearing a tulsi mala, the body, mind, words and atma become pure, and inclination toward bhakti begins to manifest spontaneously. Some type of esoteric power, some drawing power, draws one imperceptibly toward the Lord. Urdhva Pandra Tilak is known as the temple of Lord Hari, for Sri Bhagavan resides in the upward lines of the Tilak. Padmapuran says the body of a human being, which is devoid of Urdhva Pandra Tilak, is the body of such a person is compared to a crematorium. And Gopi Chan is produced from Dwarka. By wearing this tilak, by wearing Gopi Chan from Dwarka, all one's Shubha Karma produced imperishable results. By this simple act, Bhagavan becomes pleased and one attains Bhagavad Bhakti. Actually, in Padma Puran, there's a whole chapter on the glories of Dwarka tilak. Those who take Gopi Chan produced in Dwarka and apply it to their foreheads find the results of all their activities multiplied millions of times. So that's oftentimes we have what we call Gopichan. Tilak we buy in a box, and it's made by Vaidyanath. It's made in Rishikesh or Hardwar, and they put some camphor in it, and it smells nice and mixes smoothly and easily available and convenient to use, but it's bogus. It's like bogus tilak. Because tilak is mentioned here in Shastra. Tilak should come from, be the dirt of, dust of a holy place, like the dust of holy place like Vrindavan, Mayapur, the dust of Radhakund, and the dust of places where tulsi has grown and other such. Or, like if you take the dirt from a tulsi plant, even if it's growing in Poland or Germany or whatever, wherever, it's explained in Hari Bhakti Sudodaya that the dirt at the base of the tulsi plant is not different from Brajaraj, the dust of Vrindavan, even if that tulsi plant is growing in Los Angeles. And even though the dirt comes from Los Angeles, by associating with tulsi, it becomes Brajaraj, the dust of Vrindavan. So when you wear that dust on your forehead, you're wearing the dust of Vrindavan, Chintamani, Raj. This very special thing. Powerful association, transforming association. So we should be a little selective in our choice of tilaks. In Lai Bazaar, many of the markets they claim to be selling Gopichan. Some of them are people are very reputable. They bring it over by train or something. Big bags of this kacha tilak chopped up from the earth over there. So they say. But the results, whatever chanting and hearing and worship you're doing, if you're wearing tilak from Dwarka, you get benefits multiplied millions and millions of times. Yeah, well, this question is often, I've heard this question asked, the same question asked to very elevated Vaishnavas, acharyas and gurus of different missions. I've been privy to hear the same question asked and answered. And generally the gist of the answer is that it depends that some speech or action becomes blasphemy depending on the nature of the heart of the person involved. What is the position of the heart? Just like we see the actions of Kamsa and the actions of Akrura, they're both living in Mathura and they're both thinking of Krishna. But and Kamsa was absorbed in thinking of Krishna day and night, but his heart and mood were unfavorable. He wanted to kill Krishna. But he was always, it says in Gita, always think of me. So he's always thinking of Krishna. But was that considered devotion? No, it's not devotion, because the mood was unfavorable. The heart was, the motivation was unfavorable. The heart was unfavorable. So, and Akrura was, always, he was living also in Mathura, but he's Krishna's devotee. He was always thinking of Krishna in a favorable mood. So one may be a manager or a guru or leader and have to correct or critique or find faults or improve the behavior of his dependents or chastise or raise his voice or even express anger towards the dependents. But it is not considered blasphemy. It's just considered performing one's duty, as long as one is not operating from a platform of envy. Envy is not, that envy has been purged from the heart. The leader must be envy-free, or at least as much as possible, to be an effective leader. Whatever his position of leadership is, that this envy should be purged from the heart by the process of Krishna consciousness and purification. So when one is correcting someone or chastising someone, you have to examine your own internal motivation. Is this really am I acting from the platform of trying to benefit this person and trying to improve this person and trying to lovingly help this person, or am I simply trying to lord over this person and embarrass this person and assert my ego over his ego? And it's an ego battle, and it's just a competition, and it's all materially contaminated. So the internal motivation determines whether some particular speaking or acting is actually blasphemous or not. One may be extremely angry, "You stupid," and the guru's yelling at his disciple, "Why did you do this? You stupid, this, that," and maybe push him across the room and maybe slap him a few times. And someone is there, "Oh God, your guru really offended you. He slapped you, pushed you across the room." But the guru never for one second had any drop of envy. There was no envy. There was no hatred. It was only the loving mood of a mother. It was a Vatsalya Bhav. He has genuine Vatsalya Bhav. And the next 5 minutes later, it's completely forgotten. And that disciple comes in and begs forgiveness. Embraces him and says, "Don't mind, I was severe with you, but it's only out of my love for you that I'm trying to correct you so you'll never make that mistake again." So this is a very clear, when one is operating from a clear heart and his mode of operation is coming from a clear heart, free from envy, then there's no question of any blaspheming in his dealings. Of course, often many leaders are not very advanced, so there's so-called corrections and admonishments of their dependents are actually saturated with a good dose of envy and purushabhiman enjoying mentality, but on the higher end of things. So it's a little delicate principle to understand. Oh, you're offending. He's an offender. He's offending devotees. He's a blasphemer. He raised his voice. He got angry. He pushed me. He's an offender. It may not be true at all. The person who's saying the other person's an offender, he may be may become guilty of being the offender. So the inner heart of the leader is at question here, whether his speech or behavior is actually blasphemous. And Krishna is the ultimate judge, and he knows. And then, of course, the leader also knows. If he's sincere, he understands. He may check himself or catch himself sometime in the course of his chastisement or correction of a dependent or a disciple, he may see, oh, actually, there's anger inside of me. I'm not actually chastising this disciple out of love and out of a genuine mood to help them, but I'm actually envious of them because he's a better kirtan man than I am. And he sings better than I am, and I'm the guru. I should be a better singer, and he always sings better than me. Now, here's an opportunity for me to lord over him. There can be many things there going on. And then that can become blasphemous. Even the guru can become guilty of, even a so-called guru can become guilty of being a Vaishnava blasphemer. So this is the answer I've generally heard from advanced devotees. We have to see them. The underlying foundation, the foundation of the heart by which one operates, like mothers and fathers, sometimes I remember my parents would be correcting me, punishing me, slapping me, berating me, whatever. And they would say, especially when they were spanking me or cracking me physically, they'd say, I would say, ow, oh, ow. It hurts, stop, ow, ow. And then my father or my mother would say, this is a classic mantra. They would say, oh, this hurts us more than it hurts you. This hurts me. Oh, son, this hurts me more than it hurts you. I said, how is that? I said, ah. In the middle of my pain, I would start philosophizing, you know, because that's my nature, right, throughout life. I go, how is it that it hurts you more than me? Ah, oh. You know, trying to find out the reason behind their statement. What is their logic? Why? It's no, because I love you, but I don't want to do this. It really hurts me. I don't want to do this, but I have to do this. Otherwise, you won't learn your lesson. Okay, ow, ow. So, when I was young, I never quite understood the logic of that phrase, but in retrospect, I guess it all was for a good cause. So in that way, in the same way, the leader may be like that it hurts him more than it hurts the disciple. He really doesn't want to do it. He loves his disciple dearly, like his own son or daughter. And the last thing on his mind is to punish them or angrily speak to them, or maybe even slap them. But he's doing it completely consciously. He's not a victim of uncontrolled anger. He's a controlled person. He's in control of his senses. His senses don't control him. Otherwise, he's not really qualified to be guru. So his actions are conscious and controlled. So his speech and actions are all coming from a platform of transcendental understanding and realization. Yes, this is beneficial for my disciple. I must do this. But one who is a victim of anger, then he's just being propelled by tamagun, rajagun. So then it creates all anxiety. Actions performed in passion create difficulty and trouble for everyone. Last thing for the devotee or guru, whoever, the leader, he can get embroiled in a Vaishnava rod and go down. His bhakti can go down. Nice phrase that they have in the West, which is helpful in dealing with subordinates. It's one of these kind of phrases that's actually very powerful and poignant, as they say. It says, chastise in private, praise in public. Seems quite simplistic on the onset, but it's a great tool for leaders to try to follow, because what happens when a leader is actually not very spiritually advanced or in control of himself, he sees that the subordinate or disciple or dependent or servant is misbehaving or misacting, and immediately his passion, the leader's passion, flares up at seeing that infraction, and right there on the spot he wants to take action, not considering kalardeshan patra, not considering what will be the effect of his action on the consciousness and emotional stability and heart of this disciple or this dependent. So that's why this principle is very, very powerful. So the realized leader, the cool-headed leader, he'll see, oh, this person is doing this wrong thing, but I should follow this principle of praising in public and chastising in public. I mean, chastise in private and praise in public. I should let this be my guiding principle. So now here's a chance for me to make this work. I'm seeing, here I am in the Prasadam Hall, and Krishna Das does something really stupid and really he shouldn't do. And it's a bad thing he's doing. So I should chastise him, I correct him. I should do it right now to teach him. But if I do it right now, there's 100 people going to look, oh, Krishna Das, you stupid. And so then his fame and name will go down in the eyes of everyone, and he'll feel bad, and So many emotional reactions will be there, because people are very complex. People are complex entities, such a network of emotions and psychosis. So, okay, let me note this. But leaders are too passionate, and they're too busy with so many things, and they just shoot off at the helm. Hey, Krishna, what the hell are you doing? You're picking your nose and serving out the milk, you know. This and that. You know, and nobody saw it. Nobody even saw he picked his nose except you, because everyone else is too busy gorging himself on the prasadam. But you're the only one who have to even notice that he picked his nose and served the milk, which is a very moochy and bad thing to do. He should go wash his hands and this and that. And then you just cut him to pieces right there, and you go on, even excessively chastise him more than necessary because of the passion within yourself, or the uncontrolled fires burning within your own heart. And so everybody gets all doubled up in a, you know, binding knot of illusion there. But the enlightened leader said, oh, look, Krishna just did something. So he'll make a mental note or write it down in his notebook or whatever. And later on, at a quiet time, he'll call Krishna Das and say, Krishna Das, because he loves Krishna Das. Because actually, when one is operating out of love, love means, what can I do to please the beloved? What can I do to make the other person happy? Will my actions bring happiness to the other, my beloved? Will my words bring happiness? This is love. This is devotion. So a devotee, he's a perfect gentleman. The one who really has devotion, he's a perfect gentleman because he knows how to behave in a gentle way in all times, places, and circumstances. He knows how to gently deal with everyone so that to increase everyone's attraction and affection for the Lord and attraction and affection for the devotees, like himself, for example, being a representative of one devotee of the Lord. So, because I had the fortune or misfortune of trial by error, or what do you say, trial by error or error, whatever, anyway, trial by fire. I had that fortune or misfortune being a temple president for 4 years. So I had to get myself entangled in so many offensive situations, make so many offenses and pull myself out somehow or other, by repentance and by surrender and by giving lots of gifts and sweets and begging forgiveness and trial and error. And a good dose of mercy from Prabhupada and advice from elders and seniors. And by about the fourth year around the circuit, I had some idea how to go about it. Some idea. I was in America, in Baltimore, 1982 to 1986. Fortunately, it was a small temple, so I didn't accrue too many offenses. It was a bigger temple. I probably would have never made it to Vrindavan because I'd be suffering in Yamaloka right now. Because there's only about 10 devotees and at most about 18, average about 12, 18, 20 at the max. Small temple. Nityananda's mercy was able to wash away the reactions. So like that, these are some ideas to consider. But this is a very nice one from the Karmis they have. Because they're pretty good. They've been managing Ford Motor Company for a couple hundred years. Yeah, they keep pumping out these Ford motor cars and I have all these 10,000 employees, somehow they figured out how to do a few things out there. So, not that we spend much time with their ideas, but praise in public, chastise in private.
22nd one. Hari Nama Akshara Dhananam. To wear the letters of the Lord's holy name. To stamp the principal limbs of the body with chandan, forming the letters of the Lord's holy name, such as the Hare Krishna mantra, Panchatattva mantra, or other names like Jai Radhe, Radhe Radhe, is known as wearing the letters of the holy name.
So this is this first category about Tulsi wearing Tulsi beads and tilak. We mentioned how Rupa Goswami was often wearing Dhatri beads, so that's not very fashionable nowadays in Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya. Mostly we wear neck beads, Tulsi neck beads. And all Vaishnavas actually wear Tulsi neck beads. In this regard, it's told that the followers of Chaitanyaites or the Gaudiya Vaishnavas and the Ramanandis, they wear Tulsi neck beads very tightly around their neck but the Vallabhites and Madhvites, the followers of Madhvacharya, those who are worshipping Uddhavi Krishna and Dasya Bhav, or at best Sakya Bhav, Vaikuntha Bhav, and the followers of Vallabhacharya, they also wear Tulsi beads, but their habit is to wear the Tulsi Mala. It's down to their breast, so hanging on their chest, that's the way the Madhvas and Vallabhas wear their Tulsi beads. Sometimes Gaudiya Vaishnavas wear Panchamala, the time of doing puja, or when they're chanting Anik or their mantras. You see these Panchamala in the samadhis of the different Vaishnavas. Panchamala is inside a piece of cloth you see on the samadhis or the bhajan kutirs. And inside that panchamala, there's one necklace of lotus seeds, one necklace of gunja, one necklace of tulsi, one necklace of datri sometimes, or it can be the rope from Jagannath's chariot, and sometimes some amalaki bead seeds. These are considered all auspicious items to keep in a necklace. Now this next category is the 23rd category. It's called Nirmalya Dharanam, to accept the remnants of articles used by the deity. And Nectar Devotion, page 74, it says Nirmalya, accepting flower garlands. This also includes Mahatulsi, Mahachandan, or the deity's clothes. And there's a reference from Bhagavatam, Uddhava Gita. Uddhava says to Krishna, "My dear Krishna, I have taken things which you have used and enjoyed, such as mala and garments and ornaments. I eat only the remnants of your foodstuff because I am your menial servant. Therefore, because of this, I am sure that I shall not be attacked by the spell of material energy." So, this is principle to accept the clothes, garlands, sandal paste, scents, and ornaments and remnants of the deity. By doing this, one easily conquers over Maya and enters into Bhagavad Bhakti. The verse from Bhagavatam that's quoted here from 11th canto, verse 6, chapter 6, verse 46. Tvayo babukta sraganda vasolankara charchita Ochishta bojino dasas tavamayam jayemahi. So Uddhava is telling here that by wearing the remnants of articles offered to the deity, the fear of Maya cannot remain. Therefore, it's the duty of sadhakas to wear the remnants of articles offered to the Lord. Nirmalya dhritir dhati. So the phrase in Nectar Devotion says, Prabhupada's writing here, garlands of flowers and saintly articles. Actually, saintly articles is meant to be scented oils, because the Sanskrit word is ganda. And ganda means scents or fragrant oils, like chameli oil or rose oil or henna oil, sandalwood oil, champa oil, motia oil, mogar oil, champa, so many fragrant, harasinga, so many fragrant oils can be offered to the deities. This is one of the items in pancha upachara. Pancha upachara, archan marg, there are five articles that are offered to the deity. One is dupam deepam, Ganda, to offer incense, and ghee, Esha Dupo, Esha Dipo, Esha Ganda, and then Nirmalya Boga, Mishchana, and then incense, and Deepam, and Ganda, and flowers, Pushpam, and nirmalya. So this is Pancha Upachara. So all these items are offered for the pleasure of the deity in Pancha Upachara, five articles of worship. And then after Krishna enjoys them, the devotees accept them as remnants. The next category here, called dancing before the deity. So Prabhupada mentions this. He quotes the Dwarka Mahatmyam. Krishna says, a person who cheerfully and with overwhelming emotions of bhakti frantically dances in ecstasy before the deity and who manifests different features of bodily expression can burn away all the accumulated sinful reactions he has stocked up for many, many thousands of years. It also explains there in Dwarka Mahatmya. Narada says that from the body of any person who claps and dances before the deity, showing manifestations of ecstasy, all the birds of sinful activities fly upward. Just as by clapping the hands, one can cause many birds to fly away. Similarly, the birds of all sinful activities which are sitting on the body can be made to fly away simply by dancing and clapping before the deity of the Lord. So if you go into the forest and clap your hands, then the birds in the trees will fly away out of fright. So the birds of sin which are residing in the body of the Lord, on our bodies, will fly away. So this, all these different activities here actually come under a larger category of called archanam. Archanam includes number 23, which is accepting flower garlands, 24, dancing for the deity, 25, dandavat nati, bowing down in honor of the deity, 26 is standing up to receive the Lord, 27 following the deity, 28 going to the temple, 29 circumambulating the temple, and 31 rendering service to the Lord, 37 partaking of prasad, 38 drinking charanamrita, 39 smelling incense and flowers offered to the deity, 40 touching a deity, 41 seeing a deity, 42 observing arti. So this is in the Nectar Devotion, page 75. Dancing before the deity. In Sanskrit it's called Nrityam. So sadhakas, we should dance before the Sri Vigraha with a devotional attitude. So this, another rendition from this Dwarka Mahatmyam says, Yo Nrityati Parishtatma Pave Bahushu Bhaktita Sa Nirdahati Papani Manvantara Shateshvapi. Those who dance before the Lord with exuberant hearts and overwhelming devotional feelings completely destroy all their sins performed in hundreds of manvantaras. So manvantaras is a lot of time. Manvantaras means many manvantara. And manvantara is a period of time. One manvantara equals 71 yuga cycles. And one yuga cycle means Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali. So this is 432,000 years and 864,000 years. And 1,200,000 years, 1,600,000 years. So one yuga cycle equals a total of 4,320,000 years. So 4 million times, 4,320,000 times 71 equals one manvantara. So that's about 290 million years. So by dancing exuberantly before the deity, one can burn away the accumulated sinful reactions he stocked up for the last 280 million years, or 500 million years, or so many manvantaras. In other words, you can really burn up a lot of sins by dancing for the deities. So the bottom line is, or the conclusion is, everyone should, as they say, get down for the pleasure of Krishna, raise your arms above your head, and in great happiness, kick your heels, jump for joy, and chant, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol. Dance in ecstasy for the pleasure of Krishna. Then all the birds of sinful activities will fly away from the body. So the 25th item of devotion is called Dandabhat Pranam. So one should offer Dandabhat Pranams to the deity by keeping one's left side to the Lord. One should offer Dandabhat Pranams to Sri Gurudev directly facing him. And one should offer Shashtanga Dandavat Pranams with 8 limbs by extending both arms forward and falling on the ground like a stick or danda. Pranam is performed with 8 limbs. This is the meaning of pranam. 2 hands, 2 feet, 2 knees, chest and forehead, as well as vision, mind and words, is known as Ashtanga Pranam. There is also another type of pranam with 5 limbs called Panchanga Pranam. 2 knees, 2 arms, and the forehead, along with one's words and intelligence. So these are the technical descriptions of pranams. But what is the effect? The effect of offering pranam to Krishna once only is so great that even the performance of 10 Ashwamedha yagyas cannot be compared to it. Why is that? Because one who performs Ashwamedha yagyas, although he gets so much benefit in punya and sukriti and material rewards, he still has to take birth again. But one who once, only one time offers pranam to Krishna does not have to take birth again. Because if someone does so many Ashwamedha sacrifices, I think if they do 100 of them, they can go to Indraloka and become Lord Indra. And if you only do a few of them, you can go to the heavenly planets. But again, you have to die and take birth in the earth planet. But if one offers respects to the Lord, the Naradiya Purana says that he will go directly to the abode of Krishna. So that's certainly a great benediction. The next item is standing up to receive the Lord, or rising from one's seat in honor of the Lord. This is called Abhyutthanam. Brahmanda Puran says, Yinarudam pura preksha samayantam janardanam Abhyutthanam nara kurvan patiyet sarvakil visham. Says, those who see Bhagavan Sri Janardhan mounted on his chariot or palanquin, and rise from their seats to offer him respectful obeisances or salutations, have all their sins destroyed. So when one sees Sri Gurudev or Vaishnava is approaching, one should stand courteously and offer respectful salutation. This is called Abhyutthana, rising from one's seat in honor of the Lord. Bhagavan is pleased by this, and bhakti flourishes. 27th item is following the deity, is page 76. Anuvrajya, Anuvrajya, to follow behind the deity of the Lord. To faithfully follow behind, beside, or in front of the Rath Yatra procession of Krishna at the time of his touring the city is known as Anuvrajya, to follow behind the deity of the Lord. One should also follow Sri Gurudev and the Vaishnavas at the time of their arrival or departure. There's a verse Rupa Goswami quotes from Vishvapurana. Vatenasa gachanti parshvata prishtitograta vishnaneva samasarve bhavanti sapadachaya Even if a chandala or dog eater follows behind side or front of the wrath of Lord Bhagavan, he becomes worshipable as Vishnu himself. The 28th item is going to the temple of Vishnu or to places of pilgrimage.
So this is called Sri Murti Stane Gamanam. To visit the place where the Sri Murti is established.
One should visit the mandir and pastime places of Sri Bhagavan and offer respectful salutation by taking darshan, offering pranam, and reciting prayers. It says in the Puranas, Samsara Marukantara Nistara Kananashams Shamo Shlagyo Taveva Charano Yoharis Tijagamino. The 2 feet which journey to the holy tirthas of Sri Hari are praiseworthy, because by doing so they enable one to cross over the desert of this material existence. Prabhupada translates it like this. Persons who attempt to visit the holy places of pilgrimage, like Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwarka, are actually glorified. By such traveling activities, they can pass over the desert of material existence. And Hari Bhakti Sudhaya says, persons who are impelled by pure devotional service and Krishna consciousness and go to see the Vishnu deities in the temple will surely get relief from entering into the prison house of a mother's womb. That's a good benediction. The 29th principle of bhakti of the 64 lines of bhakti is prikrama, circumambulating or circumambulation. In the Nectar Devotion is circumambulating a temple of Vishnu. Skanda Purana says that during Chaturmasya period, if someone circumambulates the Vishnu temple at least four times, it is understood that he has traveled all over the universe. It's page 77, Nectar Devotion.